Esther week 15. We are on track, believe it or not, to complete Estherbrim. Susan, you never would have thunk it.
No, but we still have two more books.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. This is true. We are at the end of Perek Zayin, the end of chapter 7, and we're talking Charvona. And we've already done a lot of talking about Charvona because, you know, of the ways in which he, the ways in which his role plays into things we've already talked about. So we talked about him as one of the Sarisim who came to take Haman. We did all of that. But there are still insights to be had in this fellow Charvona and his role in the Megillah. So that's where I want to start. And then once we get through that, I want to shift gears to chapter 8 and ask a question which has bothered me a lot over the years, and maybe we'll get some clarity on it, maybe we won't. And that is the question of whether Ahasuerus was lying when he said, oh, I can't change a decree. Once the decree is made, it's set in stone. Is that true, or is that just Ahasuerus being, you know, a five-year-old? How exactly do we understand that? I say five-year-old like we don't do that all the time. I can't change. Nonetheless, let's talk Charvona first. If we finish with both of those, then we're going to talk about Mordechai's parade and his regalia and an insight which I saw several years back that really impressed me regarding that. But again, back to Charvona first. So, he doesn't have a whole lot of a role here at the end of chapter 7. Right, they are at the party. Esther has told the king that Haman is her enemy, and as we said last week, he is also the enemy of the king. He is the tsar. He is the enemy for Ahasuerus. And the king goes out to his orchard. Whatever happens out there happens. He comes back. He is livid. He is furious. And then he sees Haman lying there on the bed slash couch, whatever that is, that Esther is on. And then up pipes Charvona, chapter 7, sentence 9, Perek Zayin, Pasuk Tet. Vayomer Charvona, echad min hasarisim, lifnei amalach. Charvona, one of these sarisim, one of these officers before the king, and he says, Gam hinei ha'etz asher asa Haman leMordechai asher dibur tov al hamelech. Also, here is the tree. Here is the wood that Haman made for Mordechai, who spoke well of the king, or who spoke positively for the king. Omei beveis Haman. It's standing in Haman's house. Gavoa chamishim ama, and it's 50 amos tall. Vayomer hamelech tzluhu alav. And the king says, yeah, hang him on it. Well, that's really interesting, right? First of all, the question we've already been asking, how does Charvona know about this gallows, right? That's one question. But a second question, let's say Charvona is a good guy. He certainly helps us. We like to think of him as a good guy. If Charvona is a good guy, why did he only wake up now with this? Where has he been? Right, Jeanette, it's hard to hear you. Your sound might be low.
Sorry. I know we're having trouble with the Wi-Fi today.
This shouldn't be a Wi-Fi thing, though.
Rafael, where's the volume here?
Tech support. I did hear, I think, what you were trying to say, which is that maybe he only speaks up now because he can tell which way the wind is blowing. He was afraid to speak up until now. Now he sees the king is good and angry at Haman. Now is the time to intervene. And that's a reasonable answer. We're going to see something along those lines. Let me throw another question at you. Did you notice how he described the tree?
How tall it was, you mean? Or the
yeah.
It was...
No. Exactly. He knows the height of the tree. Did he show up with a tape measure? Like, what does that mean? He just eyeballed it and said, yeah, I think that's 50 amos. Maybe. But that's something I want to know. I want to know how he knows that this thing is 50 amos tall. So, first, in talking about Charvona, it's interesting to realize, and I never really thought about it before, that there's a whole subculture in the Megillah of Sarisim, right? The word Saris often means, and it may well mean in this context, it's not clear, a eunuch. And it's usually somebody who is that way, and that's inherent in his role in the palace. Often they're in charge of the harem. But in our story, we have quite a few Sarisim running around, and they're named. We know who they are. So that in chapter 1, we had the 7 Sarisei HaMelech, who are told to bring Vashti, and we listed them by name. Right? Anybody remember any of the names for those? If not, we're going to come back to them soon, because they matter. But there were 7 named Sarisei HaMelech. Chapter 2, we met Hegeh, who is the Saris HaMelech, appointed over the women who are brought to the king. And then Shaashgaz, who is the Saris HaMelech, who is appointed over the women after their time with the king. So, 2 more named Sarisim. That brings us to 9. Then in chapter 2, at the end of chapter 2, we met 2 more Sarisei HaMelech, right? Who were they? Chana, you're muted. Right, Bigtan and Teresh are also. That brings us to 11. Then in chapter 4, you have Hasach, right? Hasach was the Saris HaMelech who was assigned to Esther. So we have an even dozen named Sarisim here in the book. Joyce,
wasn't Charvona one of the, in chapter 1?
Bingo. I was hoping someone would ask me that question. And perhaps asking why I didn't say that there were 13, not 12, because Charvona is the 13th. And the answer is, as Joyce points out, go back to chapter 1, sentence 10. We already met Charvona. People don't notice, because it's in the first chapter, and everyone's just waiting to bang for Haman. They, would you get to, like, the action part of the book? But, Bayom HaShavi'i, Ketov Lev HaMelech Bayayin, day 7, king's feeling pretty good. Amar Limehuman, he says to Mehuman, we talked about Mehuman a little bit, and a possibility, according to some, that he is Haman. Bizisa, and then Charvona, and the rest of them. The 7 Misharsim, the 7 who are in charge of bringing Vashti to Ahasuerus. Which, parenthetically, you know, puts Charvona in a very interesting position. He's sort of the angel of death in the royal court, right? They told him to bring Vashti, and Vashti ended up dead. They tell him to bring Haman to the party in chapter 6. And now here he shows up and he's responsible for the execution of Haman. You don't want to meet Charvona. You meet Charvona, you have an issue. Nonetheless, there he was back in chapter 1. And of course he shows up here again. So who is this guy? Well, 2 schools of thought. And then we're going to talk about Shoshanas Yaakov. And these schools of thought recap a lot of what we've already said. School number 1. Is Charvona is an actual officer of the royal court, regular human guy, and was not originally a friend of ours. We have already quoted, I brought it for you on the sheet again in source number 1, the comment that Malbim made. I'm not going to read it aloud again, I brought it just that you would have it, but he makes the comment that Charvona learns about the plot of Haman when he sees the tree, when he shows up in order to bring Haman to the party at the end of chapter 6. He was in that group of Sarisim. Interestingly, while I was looking for something else entirely, I found that the Aderet Eliyahu of the Vilna Gaon on Esther chapter 7 said this before the Malbim. Not by much. I mean, the Malbim is early 19th century, Vilna Gaon's end of the 18th. That's now, though, the earliest I've seen it. So it's the Vilna Gaon as well who says it. So he's a regular human agent of the court, and that fits. It fits with chapter 1, where he's also a royal emissary. The problem with it, though, and this is noted by the Maharsha on the Gemara, is, as I asked before, how do you know that it's a 50-amma tree? You could say there's a really tall tree. How do you know it's a 50-amma tree? Maybe it was a thing. It was a unit. You know, you go to Home Depot, and they have wood in certain sizes. So there's 50-amma lumber, and it kind of doesn't look like your regular 2x4. So maybe that's what's going on. But the Gemara in Megillah offers a very interesting alternative idea, and Jeanette's idea of him knowing which way the wind blows. Well, take a look at this. Says the Gemara, it's based on a pasuk in Iyov. They're taking the sentence from Iyov a little bit, not literally, but you'll see. Amar Rabbi Elazar, Av Charvona Rasha Ba'osa Eitzahaya. Charvona was wicked. Charvona was part of the plot. The plot, again, to hang Mordechai. Kevin Shara'ashlo Niskaima Atzaso Miyad Barach. And he saw that things weren't going well. And he said, I think I'm going to take a left turn. Instead of hanging Mordechai, maybe I'll turn on Haman instead. And that's where they quote you the pasuk from Iyov, Vayashlech alav velo yachmol miyado baruach yivrach, which in context, it's talking about a wicked person fleeing when somebody attacks him. He's saying here, it's the wicked person who actually, it's him being the one who's turning on, well, it is still the wicked one fleeing, but if you take it more literally, it would be Haman who was described as fleeing, not Charvona. But I'm neither here nor there. I don't want to confuse matters. The Gemara suggests that he knows about everything because he was actually in the plot. The Vilna Gaon doesn't seem to think that he's actually a bad guy the way the Gemara portrays it, but that's the way the Gemara does. So, Charvona then had every reason not to intervene before because he wanted to see it come to fruition. It's only now that he changes his mind. And there's an interesting way to see that in the text itself. Go back to Charvona's words. Chapter 7, sentence 9. Did you notice the way he began?
Gum.
Also, right? They told us in school, you are not supposed to, if you're writing a composition, you're not supposed to start with also. But that's exactly what he's doing. He's actually mirroring Achashverosh. Because Achashverosh's previous sentence began with Hagam. Right? Hagam lichbosh. So he begins with Gam hinei ha'etz. That's the idea. And Professor Yonatan Grossman supports this with a very interesting idea. He points you to Ibn Ezra. Take a look at source number 3. Right before Charvona chimed in, we were told, Hadavar yatsami pi hamelech, the word went forth from the king, ufnei haman chafu. Let me ask the people who have translations here. Anyone have a Koran, a JPS, an art scroll? Tell me something. The end of sentence 8, ufnei haman chafu. How do your translations render that? Yes,
they
Susan.
They covered Haman's face.
They covered Haman's face. Which translation? You have the Judaica Press one, right?
The pink one.
The pink one, yeah. Gita?
Yeah, I have JPS also.
Yeah.
It's covered.
It says who covered? It says they covered his face?
They covered Haman's face.
Okay, good. So when I was reading this always as a student always learning this, I understood Ufnei Haman Chafu meant that his face went dark, just like he was in the previous chapter, a veil of a chafui rosh. He was in mourning, his head was, literally, the word chafu and chafui is like chupah. It's to be covered. So, what they say, what you're seeing in your translations there, JPS and Judaica Press, is from Ibn Ezra. Take a look at source number 3. Ufnei Haman Chafu is saying somebody else covered Haman's face. He says, Hamisharasim, the servants did it. Vehatam kisu panav kichen mishpat malchei paras. Sheichasu avdei hamelech pnei misha ka'as alav hamelech. Shalo yir enu od hamelech. He says, the king doesn't want to see you now. That's essentially what's happening. Achashverosh doesn't want to see him. We're going to cover his face. And that apparently was a royal protocol. If you were in the king's court and the king, you fell out of favor with the king should not see you. They would actually, I don't know if they put a hood on him or what it was. And he says, "Vizet davar yadua b'sifrei paras." This is known from the Persian records. And the truth of the matter is that as I've read a little bit more, I found that you see this in modern writers as well about that era. This was a thing. They would actually cover the face of the person who had fallen out of favor with the king. So, Charvona, with the word gam, right, jumps on that covering of Haman's face. And one other point here that shows that he's really not dispassionate, he's not a neutral party, is the way he describes Mordechai. Right? He didn't just say, here's the tree they plan to hang Mordechai on. Here's the tree that they prepared for Mordechai, who spoke well of the king. Mordechai, who saved your life. There's no question that at this point he's trying to promote Mordechai and destroy Haman. So that's all one school of thought. He's a regular guy, potentially a plotter with Haman, who changes sides. Yes, Susan.
This is more a technical question, I guess you'd say. Here they talk about covering the head. Is this like the precursor to all, you know, when they hung people, they covered their head? When they covered their head a lot, you think it was taken from here?
I don't know. More likely that this would reflect a known practice, meaning this is late enough in history that the practice of hanging has been going on for a long time in different cultures.
But covering the head was just...
I mean, covering the head would be done just logically to avoid exposing the population to what's going to happen. You know, people are very squeamish about the person they're killing. I wouldn't assume it came from here. I'd be interested to know, but I don't know. The other school of thought is that Charvona is a supernatural agent. Charvona is not regular guy, and that's how Charvona knows about the tree and knows about the height of the tree as well. Ah, but why didn't he intervene before? Because now is the opportune moment. This is when divulging something like this is going to work, because now the king already knows about Mordechai, right? And now the king already suspects Haman from his party with Esther. This is the opportune moment. And in fact, the Medrash in Esther Rabbah, and you've heard this before, says there was a real Charvona in chapter 1, and he's in a closet somewhere. Take a look at source number 4, the Medrash in Esther Rabbah. Ma asa Eliyahu zachur latov. What did Eliyahu, who was remembered for the good, what did he do? Nidmela Charvona. He appeared like Charvona. So he ties up Charvona, leaves him somewhere where no one's going to find him. And then he makes himself look like Charvona, because why not? He's Eliyahu Anavi. Va'amarlo, and he said to the king, Adoni HaMelech, gam hinei ha'etz asher asa haman l'Mordechai, oh, king, here is, and so on. De'amar Rabbi Pinchas, and then the Medrash continues, and this is where we're going to be going with this. Rabbi Pinchas says, Tzarich lomar Charvona zachur latov. That on Purim you have to say, Charvona, he should be remembered for the good. And I'm going to come back to the rest of that line in the Medrash shortly. I'm holding it for right now. But the idea is that actually Charvona is, call it supernatural. He's Eliyahu Hanavi. So that brings us, and that piece that we read in Esther Rabbah brings us, to the question of how to read Shoshanas Yaakov. There is a poem which is recited after the Megillah is read. The poem is called Asher Heini, right? Alphabetical acrostic. And at the end of Asher Heini, there are the lines, Shoshanas Yaakov, right? That we sing. So, what does Shoshanas Yaakov, which specifically mentions Charvona, what does it believe about Charvona? So, the answer is, you could make different arguments. But there are four pieces of evidence in Shoshanas Yaakov about what it believes. First of all, the very fact that Shoshanas Yaakov talks about thanking Charvona, well, before I do that, I think what I ought to do is jump to source number 6, and the part that I put in that's kind of indented, that's the quote from Shoshanas Yaakov. In case anyone is not familiar with the words, it's a good idea that we actually read the words themselves. So you can read the Hebrew or the indented English in source number 6 as part of my quote from Professor Grossman. Arur Haman asher bikesh la'abdi, Right? Cursed is Haman, who tried to destroy me. Baruch Mordechai HaYehudi, blessed is Mordechai of Yehud. Arura Zeresh, Eshes Mafchidi, cursed is Zeresh, the wife of the one who terrorized me. Brucha Esther Ba'adi, Esther is blessed for me. Arurim Kol Rasha'im, Bruchim Kol Tzadikim, that one doesn't make it into the song because it doesn't fit the rhyme and the rhythm and all of that. But it is in the original. The cursed are all the wicked, blessed are all the righteous. V'gam Charvona Zachur Latov. And also Charvona is remembered for the good. So, evidence number one is the fact that you mention him to be thanked. If he's just an angel doing God's bidding, he doesn't get to be thanked. That's what angels do. The idea that we're going to thank him suggests that that there's something supernatural. Although, now I take us back to source number four, in which the same medrash that brought us that he is Eliyahu also quoted Rabbi Pinchas saying, you have to say, Charvona Zachor Latov, which indicates that no, he's actually supernatural. That medrash then continues, Ve'amar Rav, still a number four. Rav said, Tzarech Lomar Arur Haman Arurim Banav Arur Zeresh Ishto. You also have to mention, cursed is Haman, cursed are his sons, cursed is his wife Zeresh. Why? Because we have a pasuk in Mishlei, right? The verse says, V'shem Rishaim Yirkav, the name of the wicked will rot. And of course, the other part of that pasuk, which we hopefully get to use more often, is, what's the first half of that pasuk in Mishlei? Susan knows, because I emailed you about it in connection with your daughter's article. Zecher Tzadik Livracha is the first half of that sentence. The Zecher Tzadik Livracha V'shem Rishaim Yirkav. The memory of the righteous is for a bracha. The name of the wicked should rot. So we have another medrash in Bereishis Rabba that brings us the Zecher Tzadik Livracha part. But the bottom line is that you could say mentioning Charvona, giving him credit, sounds like he was a good guy. Although this medrash, which talks about honoring him, includes the idea that he's Eliyahu. So that's not dispositive. The words Zachur Latov are meant to indicate for us that he is not human. Right? Are meant to indicate that he is Eliyahu. That's what that medrash is doing. It says Eliyahu Zachur Latov and Charvona Zachur Latov. Even though the truth of the matter is that the Gemara uses the phrase Zachur Latov and the Mishnah uses the phrase Zachur Latov all the time. It comes up a lot in the Mishnah as a way to honor someone who has done something good. So as an example, I brought you source number 5. It has nothing to do with Esther. I know some people look at the source sheet in advance, which I wholeheartedly applaud. They might have looked at source number 5 and said, what in the world does this have to do with anything? And the answer is nothing except the phrase Zachur Latov. It's talking about the laws of competition in business. And the opening source in source number 5 in the Mishnah is Rabbi Yehuda speaking. And Rabbi Yehuda says, I don't want you competing unfairly with other businesses by giving kids sweets in order to bring them into your store when that's not what your merchandise is. You're doing it just to get the kids into the stores that their parents are going to come buy things. Right? That's Rabbi Yehuda. He says, that's not fair competition. And the Chachamim say, no, that's okay. You're allowed to do that. And then Rabbi Yehuda also says, Lo Yifchos Es Hasha'ar. Back in the days of the Mishnah, this is the time when the Emperor Diocletian among the Romans had created all sorts of price regulations. And the Jews lived under that system as well. And so the rule was that if a price is regulated, you're not allowed to undercut the price. That was Rabbi Yehuda's position. If you undercut the price, you're harming the other businesses. That's not fair. And the Chachamim said, no, go for it. We like low prices. The Chachamim responded with, Zachur Latov. Someone who does that is remembered for the good. My point in bringing it is just to show you the phrase Zachur Latov is a common one in the Mishnah. It comes up all sorts of different occasions. nonetheless, I do think that Zachor LaTov here is meant to be an Eliyahu link. Eliyahu is called Zachor LaTov. Charvonat is called Zachor LaTov. And Eliyahu is known as with this, you know, Zachor LaTov phrase all over Mishnah, Bavli, Yerushalmi. Okay, so what we have so far, hang on one second, Bria. What we have so far is honoring Charvona makes it sound like he's a human being. However, we brought the idea of honoring him in the same medrash that said he's Eliyahu. The fact that we say Zachor LaTov is something that we often say for human beings. But again, in this medrash, they seem to be tying it specifically to the Zachor LaTov of Eliyahu. So I can still be firmly on the fence with this. Yes, Bruya.
Just to clarify, in the beginning, in Perek Aleph, he was mentioned. Was he also Eliyahu then, or was just at the end when we're talking about him now that he is Eliyahu?
So it sounds to me from the wording in number 4 in that medrash that he only shows up in the middle to become Eliyahu, to take the place of Charvona. There is a real Charvona, and Eliyahu takes his place.
Okay, so the real Charvona disappears.
The real Charvona disappears. It's possible, okay. It's possible to suggest, I suppose, tying this with Rabbi Elazar in source number 2, the real Charvona fled when he saw Mordechai was being honored. He realized things weren't going to be any good, and at that point, that's when Eliyahu comes in to fill his spot, because no one's going to catch him. No one's going to realize.
I like that.
So yeah, that could be. Gita, you were going to say?
No, a tiny thing. You talk about the Zifono Levacha, Zecher Sadiq. It appears in every obituary.
Well, that's, yeah, the Zecher, either Zichrono Levracha or Zecher Tzadik Levracha is certainly one that we use commonly. I was talking about Zachor LaTov.
Ah.
Yeah.
Okay. I wonder
what makes the Chachamim bring in Eliyahu. There must be something, because it's so logical. At Perek Aleph, he was to get with Meruman doing the same, and it says by Zeresh that she and Ohavav said the same thing, so he must have been close to Haman. Makes sense that he was in the plot, because it's close to Haman. He was one of Ohavav.
So it certainly...
Logically, it makes sense. I don't understand what makes them... It's always a reason to trigger it.
Yeah, no, and I think their trigger is two things. Number one, how does he know the height? Which you can answer by saying he was part of the plot. But if you say he was part of the plot, then the question is, why does he turn here? To which the answer could well be because he knows Haman's lost. But it could also be because this actually isn't the original Charvona. This is somebody masquerading as Charvona. But yeah, and I understand.
Yes,
Janine.
Sorry.
Oh, sorry,
Janine.
Go ahead, Janine. Okay, I just wanted to ask, the same place where it says that you say Arur, Haman, etc., does it also say there, Baruch, the other...
So, not in Esther Rabbah in source number 4, but in the version of this in Bereishis Rabbah, which I didn't bother to bring you on the sheet, but in Bereishis Rabbah, you find the flip side, the positive side as well. It's Memtet Aleph, if you wanted to look at it there.
I'm just asking because maybe they think that it's speaking about a different person, because he uses a different terminology. It doesn't say Baruch, it says Zachor LaTov.
Yeah.
Maybe you can't pass a... I always understood it differently, that in each one of the first one, you have Achashverosh, Haman and Mordechai, Esther and Zeresh, you have the Rasha and the Tzadik, and by Charvona, there's no balance. He's the balance. He's bad and good.
That's, so hang on 1 minute with that thought, because that's where we're going next in source number 6. But nope, that's fine, Chana. Yes, Jeanette, you were going to say?
I was just going to say in answer to Chana that what the Chachamim had trouble with was if all he was this bad guy, basically, who was in on the plot, really would have liked Haman to succeed, but he didn't want to go down with the ship, so he's an opportunist, I don't think we would say Bagam Chorbana Zohor Latov. I think that's where they had to find a different explanation. Because if he was just an opportunist who, you know, jumped in to save his own neck,
I think the Kol Elch Lefi HaMaaseh, his last deed was good, actually.
Yeah. I mean, the other piece of it, though, is that it's the decision that he is somebody special, which may be what drives the Zachor Latov. So rather than interpret backward, they would interpret forward. But take a look at number 6, where Professor Yonatan Grossman notes what Hannah had noted about the structure. He says, he says, Drishat Rav Zu, this exegesis, this drasha by Rav, by which he's referring to what we said back in source number 4, that you have to say Arur Haman and so on, is found in these lines at the end of the poem of Asher Heini, and I brought you the 4 lines. And then he says, Mishpatei ha-bracha va-ha-klala mangidim b'shloshat smadim es ha-arurim mul ha-biruchim. He says, the 3 pairs that you have place the cursed opposite the blessed. So it's Haman, Mordechai, Zeresh, Esther, Rishayim, Tzadikim, and he says, Potchim b'giborei ha-megillah. You start with the main figures in the Megillah. Ha-givarim, the males, Haman, Mordechai, Vahanashim, Zeresh, Esther, Umitoch, Giborei HaMegillah, and then having mentioned the main figures, Ovrim La Amira Klalit, we make a general statement, Umatzivim Es Kol HaRishayim Mul Kol HaTzadikim, we place all the bad guys opposite all the good guys, and Vitoch Shenishbar HaMivneha Nigudi, and then having broken that juxtaposition in the structure, this one opposite that one, and this is what Chana was pointing out. Anu mosifim, we add vigam charvona zachur latov, and also charvona is remembered for the good. Yusam leiv charvona, you know, baruch kemordechai, Esther ukechol atzadikim ulam hu zachur latov. He doesn't get baruch, he gets zachur latov. So you could read this in a lot of different ways. Professor Grossman doesn't really do anything with it. He just sort of points out the structural difference. You could suggest it means to say, because he's not one of us, so to speak, he's a Persian official. You could look at it and say that it reflects a degree of ambivalence about him, that he was, as Jeanette is saying, if he was a bad guy who then did something good, then maybe we are ambivalent. And I think that's where Chana is going with this, by saying he's a hybrid, right? He doesn't belong on one side or on the other side. He's somebody who has both elements within him. So we have 3 pieces of evidence which you could read either way. We have the fact that we mention him. We have the Zachor Latov reference. And we have the fact that he doesn't fit into the normal structure that we use for the other heroes and villains of the Purim story. The only other thing I would note here is that word Vigam. Vigam Charvona Zachor Latov. Which really makes it seem like he's an add-on. He's not like the others. But then I wonder, and I know Chana, I can see the smile already, because Chana's already thought of this. Vigam Charvona Zachor Latov, maybe it means the gam of Charvona is remembered for the good. The gam with which he chimed in, gam hine ha'etz. The gam of Charvona is remembered for the good. I wonder if that's not what the poem is saying. Possible. Okay, so we are now more educated about Charvona, but we have no conclusions about who he was. We just have possibilities, which, as far as I'm concerned, is just fine, because nothing is really clear about Purim anyway. I gave you a list of review questions covering the previous 2 chapters, chapters 6 and 7. Going back to the question of why Mordechai's parade matters, whether that's the impact of Hashem's hands starting to come to fruition, or of Esther's plot coming to fruition, depending on how you look at the whole story. What does Esther mean when she says the tsar would not be worth the harm to the king? So is it the simple read, the trouble we face isn't worth troubling the king with it, or the enemy doesn't care about harming the king, or the enemy tricked you and is harming the king? How does Charvona know about the tree? Why wasn't he afraid to intervene at this point in the party? Either he's a servant who sees the way the wind is blowing, or he's a divine agent. And again, he could have been part of the plot, maybe. And then the pieces of evidence indicating what the song Shoshana Yaakov believes about Charvona, his inclusion, Zachor Latov, the structural difference, and the Vigam. Those are the points. Okay. So with that in mind, we turn to Perek Chet, chapter 8. And in chapter 8, we start out immediately with the result of Haman's removal, right? You get fooled by the chapter breaks in Tanakh. This happens all the time. So you start chapter 8 and you find out Mordechai was just elevated over the house of Haman and all that. Well, of course he was, because the very previous sentence was they hanged Haman. So someone's got to take charge. So Mordechai is elevated to the Haman's position. Then Esther comes to Ahasuerus and says, you know, there's still the matter of this decree against my people. Ahasuerus, sorry, I actually have a mistake on the sheet there. It should not say Esther will not rescind. It should say Ahasuerus will not rescind the decree. But he allows the Jews to defend themselves. Very magnanimous of him. And finally, Mordechai is elevated and honored, and he gets a second parade around the city, and people are mityahadim, which is a term that I have to come back to that we're not getting to this week. Okay. Why can't Ahasuerus rescind the decree? Let's take a look at the verse, first of all. We shouldn't just talk about it. We should see it. Perek Chet, Pasuk Gimel, chapter 8, sentence 3. Vatosef Esther, Vatdaber lifnei amelech. Esther continued, right, beyond the speech that she gave in chapter 7. And she spoke before the king. Vatipol lifnei raglav, she falls at his feet. Vatevk, she cries. Vatischane lo, she pleads with him. Lahaavir esra'as haman ha'agagi, to remove the evil of haman of Agag. And machshavto asher chashav al hayehudim, his plot against the Jews. And the king extends the golden scepter, and Esther gets up, and she stands before the king. That's our second time when Esther is now marching in on the king and getting accepted. But again, as we noted when we talked about pairs, the atmosphere is different this time. It's more obvious that the king is going to accept her, and that's played out in the trup, right, in the notes with which we sing it. Because when he first did this back in chapter 5, it was Vayoshed HaMelech. Whereas here it's Vayoshed HaMelech LeEsther. It's just normal. It's part of the story. No one makes a big deal out of that. But what is a big deal is she makes her pitch to the king, and she says, please retract the scrolls that were sent out with this plan to destroy the Jews. And Ahasuerus says in Pasuk Zion, in sentence 7, he says, sorry, I've already given the house of Haman over. We've hanged Haman as well. So what I want you to do, he says, is write a message to the Jews, whatever you want to say in my name, because you can't retract that which has already been ordered, which is understood to mean you can't retract the original order. That's the idea. You won't be able to retract the new order. Right? When I say the Jews are allowed to defend themselves, that won't change. And the original decree can't be rescinded either. So, what do you think? Is Ahasuerus for real here when he says you can't retract the original order? Is that a thing? Sorry, Susan and then Hannah.
I think we'd have to know we learned the history of the time was to cover the heads.
Yeah. So what do we know about their history then? Right.
Yeah, that's what I...
Okay, Hannah?
I don't know if it's a Midrash, but Belshazzar saw the same thing when he saw the Pisahiyah, and then he went out and he said no one comes in, and he couldn't come in because that's what he said. They killed him because he couldn't go against his own decree. I think it was in their kingdoms it was a law. And also the fact that Ahasuerus is imitating the Beis HaMikdash, and according to Gemara he's doing all kinds of things to imitate. Maybe he's imitating the Torah. His words are Torah. You can change them.
So whatever I decree is like Torah now.
But he changed his mind when he didn't hang Mordechai.
Well, Ahasuerus never decreed to hang Mordechai, though. Haman never got that far.
He says, if I signed it, that's it.
Yeah. So the gut read, when I, you know, learned this as a kid, was this is Ahasuerus being Ahasuerus, right? He just doesn't want to back down. This is a guy who we know is insecure, He's very concerned about appearances. We saw that back in chapter one, when he's so worried about what it's going to look like, when Vashti won't listen to him and all of that. So it could be he's insecure about changing his policies, and also he's selfishly focused on his own well-being. Right? Esther's fine. My queen is okay. So who cares what happens to everybody else? Yeah, that's one way to read it. And there is evidence to support this. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 7, I gave you a reference to Psukim in Ezra. Some of you were with me when we did Ezra on Tuesdays. Take a look in your Tanakh in Sefer Ezra. I'm just trying to see what I did with mine. I must have left it elsewhere. Bummer. Okay. But in Ezra chapter 4, sentences 17 to 22. Ezra chapter 4 is an extremely problematic chapter. It's very unclear in terms of when this story that is told here takes place. But we don't need to get involved in the whole story, and we don't need to discuss the background on it. This is talking about an attempt made by the Samaritans to halt construction of the Beis HaMikdash, or to halt construction of the walls to defend Jerusalem. That's part of the debate. Those of you who were here with me when we did Ezra will remember, we spent a lot of time trying to figure out when this took place. All right, Joyce was there, Alina was there. Gita, were you there when we did Ezra? No. Susan, I think, Susan, you were there. If you weren't in Florida when we did that chapter. Bray, you were there? Okay. So we have some people who were there when we discussed this and who will remember the headaches we had trying to figure this out. But the bottom line is this. Chapter 4 in Sefer Ezra starts out with a depiction of attempts by the locals, we know them as the Samaritans, to stop the Jews' path of construction and building for themselves, as had been, in fact, allowed by Koresh, by Cyrus. And the way they do it in this particular story is they have a letter sent to the king, to Artaxasta, saying to him, if the Jews are going to be allowed to build up their defenses the way they're doing, then they're going to stop paying you taxes. They're going to declare themselves autonomous. And based on the letter that is sent, we now get to Ezra Perek Dalet Pasuk Yud Zayin, chapter 4, sentence 17, which reads as follows. Pisgama shlach malka al rechumbal te'em v'shimshai safra u'shar k'navas haun diyasvin b'shamrayin. In case you're wondering, for those who don't have it in front of you, it's in Aramaic, it's not in Hebrew. The u'shar avarnara shlamu ke'es. A letter is sent out from the king on the word of his agents, and Shimshai the Sofer in particular. Nishtevana dishlachten aleina mafarash krei kadamai. He says, I read the letter that you sent me. You sent me a letter describing the fear that the Jews are going to rebel and that that's the history of these Jews. And he continues to say, Umini sim te'emu v'akaru v'hashkachu. He says, I gave the order and it was investigated and found. Di kiryas sadach min yomas alma almalchin misnasa. That this city of Jerusalem is a city that always revolts against kings. These Jews are trouble. At least he got one thing right. And he says, Umarad ve'eshtadur mis'aved ba, they're gonna rebel, they always rebel. And therefore he says, in sentence 21, Ka'an simu te'em levataya ilech. He says, this is the order, I want you to stop all this construction. V'kiryas adach lasis b'nei, this city shall not be built up, ad mini tama yitzam, until I give the order. So, in this passage, Artaxasta says, stop the construction. But the construction was going on by royal order of King Cyrus. So doesn't that demonstrate that they are able to back out? Right? You can rescind a decree. He just did it. Artaxasta did it. He rescinded the decree of Cyrus. So doesn't that prove that Ahasuerus is lying? The answer is not necessarily. Because we have precedent as well to show that, in fact, they are not able to rescind. Daniel Perek Vav. If you take a look at source number 8, Daniel chapter 6. a classic story, Daniel and the Lion's Den. Some of you were here when we did Daniel. That's further along, that's longer ago than when we did Ezra and Nehemiah. Debbie, were you there for Daniel? No? Okay. So, the story in Daniel chapter 6 is that there is a new king, Darius the Mede. And Darius the Mede is 62 years old when he takes over, and he has no interest in running the kingdom at all. He appoints 120 people and says, "You guys run the show. I don't need to be involved. Thank you very much." And he has three people the 120 have to report to. However, one of those three people who are placed over the 120, one of those three people is Daniel. And there are a lot of people in the king's court who don't like Daniel. And so they say, "You know what we're going to do? We're going to trap Daniel." And they go to Darius and they say, "You're not really going to be very hands-on as a king. Aren't you afraid that people aren't going to be loyal to you? Aren't you afraid that people are going to flout you because you're just sort of hanging out in your palace? Here's what you ought to do. Issue a decree that says that for 30 days, no requests may be made of anyone other than you. If anybody wants anything, a glass of water, they have to ask you for it, O king, just for 30 days. And that way you'll establish your authority." That's what they say to him, which is a bizarre and unsupportable idea. I mean, you can't govern for a day like that. Nonetheless, that's what they convince him to accept. That's the order. And they do it because, as recorded there in Daniel chapter 6, Daniel has a practice of praying to God at his window facing Yerushalayim three times a day. Well, praying to your God is a violation of the royal order. So sure enough, Daniel hears about the decree. He goes up to his window. He prays towards Yerushalayim. They spot him, and then they report it to Darius. But they're very clever about how they report it to Darius. They're very smart in the words they use. And here I refer you to Daniel chapter 6. And do I have my Daniel here? Yes, I do, actually. Okay. So, chapter 6, sentence 12. Edayin, at this point, Guvraya ile hargishu v'hashkachu leDaniel. These people, the people who were plotting against Daniel, went and found Daniel. Boyu mischanan kadem elokei. They find him davening to his God. Bedayin krivu va'armin kadamalka. So they go to the king and they say, "Al esar malka hala es regarding the royal decree hala esar reshamta. Didn't you issue an order? Dicholanash di yivemin kol alaka ve'enosh ad yomin tlasin lahein minach malka yisramela goryavasa. Didn't you decree that anyone who asks for anything from God or man in the next 30 days will be thrown to the lions? Didn't you issue such a decree?" Ane Malkava Omar, and the king responds and says, "Yatsiva Milsa Kedas Madayu Paras Dila Se'edei." This is it. That's the order. It's the decree of Madayu Paras, and it shall not be removed. Sentence 14. Bedayin Anova Amrin Kada Malka, and then they tell the king, "Di Daniel Dimin Bnei Galusa Di Yehud La Sam Alach Malka Te'em Valasara Di Rishamta." He says, "You should know, this Jew, Daniel, the guy from Yehud, he doesn't pay attention to what you order. He's not listening to your commands." Vizim Nitlasa Biyoma Bai Ba'use. Three times a day he prays the chutzpah. Edayin Malka Kedi Milsa Shema. And when the king hears this, Sagi Be'esh Alohi, he is very upset. Vadaniel some bal l'shezavu say, he tries to find some strategy to get Daniel out of it. Va'admale shimsha hava mishtadar l'hatzalu say, he spends until sunset trying to spare Daniel. He doesn't want Daniel hurt. But there's nothing he can do. And that's the next sentence, the key sentence, chapter 6, sentence 16. Bedayin guvraya ileh hargishu al malka. These people came to the king, ve'armen the malka, and they said to him, "Da malka, you have to know, O king, the das le madayu faras, the rule in Media and Persia is di chol eser ukiyam di malka yahakim la lahashnaya. Royal decrees cannot be changed. You're out of luck. And of course, we know the way the story plays out. Daniil is thrown to the lions. He's fine. Then the other people are thrown to the lions, and they're not so fine. So this passage supports the idea that, in fact, you can't change the decree, so much so that Abarbanel, and I brought it for you in source number 9, in his commentary to Daniil, Abarbanel doesn't write his commentary to Daniil like as part of his normal commentaries. It's part of a book called Ma'ayanei HaYeshua. And that's what I'm quoting here. He says, they sprung the trap on the king in this very clever way. Hem yadusha melech hayohev Daniel. They knew the king loved Daniel. Vim hayu magidim lo betchila hadavar masha'asa Daniel. If they started out by saying, hey, Daniel was praying, chashashu ulai hamelech bavaso oso yakhish hadavar. They thought that then the king, loving Daniel as he did, would contradict them. He'd deny it. V'yomar lo kach haisa kavanasi. That wasn't what I meant. O lo dibartim elai kacha. Or you didn't speak this way to me when you gave me the advice to create this. Ushar atanos hatoanos latzilo miyadam. Or give other excuses, other claims in order to save him. Lachein hischak mu lishol lo rishona al etzem hadas. So first they said to him, isn't there such a rule to get him to confirm that? Once the king acknowledged that there was such a rule, then Anuva Amrulosha Daniel, they told him that Daniel had done. So the bottom line here is this. Daniel seems to show you that in fact a king could not rescind his decree. Now Susan asked particular historical records. So the only thing I've been able to find reference to is the following story in Herodotus. If you take a look at source number 10, in Herodotus' histories, keep in mind they're written by a Greek about the Persians, but in this case I don't think that that's particularly relevant. You get a story regarding Xerxes, who may have been Koresh, or Ahasuerus, and his wife Amestris. And well, it's not really about Amestris. Unfortunately, it's about Artint rather than Amestris. But that's the way the story plays out here. You can read the story here from the Herodotus text that I cut and pasted online, but I'll just tell you the story as it's presented here is that Xerxes is married to Amestris. However, he's involved with another woman named Artain. And he offers her whatever she wants. She says to him, will you give me whatever I ask of you? And he promises that he will. And she asks him for this special mantle that his wife has given him. That's what she demands of him. And he tries to refuse her, as the text goes on to say. He offers her cities. He offers her an army to command. But he can't move her. He can't convince her. And ultimately, he gives her the mantle. So this gets quoted to say that kings in that empire, in fact, were not able to back down. I don't think this is really proof, because this isn't a royal decree. This is just a promise a guy made to his lover. It's not, there's nothing here to prove the status of royal decrees in Persia. So we don't have enough evidence to really work with it. But the answer is very possible that Ahasuerus is actually telling the truth here. Yes, Susan.
I'm looking at Pasuk Beit. Gives the tabat to Mordechai.
Yeah.
How come Mordechai, now as the king's right-hand man, couldn't have approached the king when he was in that position, instead of Esther, in a sense of this is better for your realm? They'll earn money for you. You'll do what, you know? Why? He was safer to go to the king because he was his right-hand man and he'd have to check with him. So to me, since he got the ring before Esther asked him, it would seem more logical that it was Mordechai's job now to go.
So it's an interesting argument, and I could hear you, meaning Ahasuerus has been, we've said since the beginning, he's a schemer, he's a plotter, he's always looking for an edge and an advantage, and Mordechai may be able to make that claim. At the same time, Ahasuerus has shown his willingness to listen to Esther. You know, it could be you go with a hot hand, right? You go with somebody who is currently successful. And it could be that Mordechai is ready to try if Esther doesn't succeed. But I think Esther has already proven that she has Achashverosh's ear. Chana, you were going to say? You're muted.
The fact that Mordechai has a ring doesn't give him power. Haman has had the ring when he was hanged, so that's not...
Well, true, but Haman also had Achashverosh's ear until he sabotaged himself.
Yeah.
You know, he brought himself down. I think Susan's point is valid. I just think that Esther is the one who is in a better position. So I think it's possible that Achashverosh is really telling the truth here, that he really can't back down. What about then in Ezra chapter 4? How did they rescind Cyrus's decree? So Malbim in Ezra offers an approach that may help. He says, Achashverosh ze'be'atzmo nasandas livnoso. He asks the question. Cyrus gave the order to build the Beis HaMikdash. Va'amar she'Hashem pakadalav livnos labayis. Cyrus even says, God told me to do it. We had a lot of discussion about that in Sefer Ezra. Eich bi'amim mu'atim achziras hadas u'bitel habinyan. How is it that Artaxerxes came along and rescind the decree? V'yadanu, he says, we know. Ki b'dasei paras u'madai kol k'sav she'nechta b'shem ha'melech lo yachol ha'melech levatzlo b'shum ofen. He says, we know you're not allowed to rescind a royal decree in these lands. K'mavur b'inyan Daniel u'b'inyan Achashverosh, in the cases that we just brought as proof. Daniel and Esther. He says, I don't understand. Zos Shenis, and he says, second, Shem Kasvu Shehudim Bonim u'mavatzim Chomos Yerushalayim v'zeh Sheker Gomer Shlebonu Rakas Habayis. That's a separate note in terms of the story itself that's going on there in Ezra, which is, he assumes that this story where they challenged the construction of the Beis HaMikdash was early on, when we were building the Beis HaMikdash. But the letter they sent to the king said that we were building the walls of the city. He says, how do you get away with lying about what they were doing? So he gives you a very interesting answer. And I didn't bring you the whole thing here. It's long and involved, and you need to know the text there in order to really follow. But basically what he suggests is that they told the king that the Jews were not following Cyrus's original order. That Cyrus's order was to build the Beis HaMikdash, and that they weren't doing that. They were building the defenses of the city. And therefore, they argued, you're not rescinding the original decree. That's not what you're doing. You're blocking them from a completely separate thing that they're doing. That's really the, you've been tricked entirely, and therefore you are justified in blocking this construction. So that's how Malbim deals with it. So what we've come up with today in the course of our hour is, number one, Charbonah could be read either way, could be a human being, could even be part of the plot. But now, he decides that he's going to be on the good guy's side. He realizes it's in his own best interest, perhaps. Nonetheless, we say Zachur Latov. We remember him for the good, and it's even considered a mitzvah. I didn't mention this before. I forgot to mention it. But this statement that you're supposed to say, Arur Haman, Arur Zeresh, Brucha Esther, and all of that, and Gam Charbonah, is actually brought in Shulchan Aruch. It's brought as halacha, that's what one is supposed to do on Purim. Now makes it into the Shulchan Aruch. And then the second point, that Achashverosh is not able to rescind the decree, he's probably telling the truth, that he really is not able to rescind the decree. So what I want to do next time is tackle the issue of Purim costumes and where costumes come from. Are they rooted in Esther getting dressed up? Are they rooted in Mordechai's parade? And we'll see some fascinating proof about this and regarding the origin of Purim costumes, and I want to find out what it means when it says that people were mityahadim. Literally, it sounds like people were becoming Jewish, which is a little bit strange. We have to figure out what that means. But if you want to prepare for next week, take a look at chapter 8, sentence 15. Yeah, chapter 8, sentence 15. And there is something very strange about the description of Mordechai's clothing there. So that'll be for next week. Okay? Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Be well.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Rabbi.